To be seated, please. I'm Steve Katz, director of the National Institute of Arthritis and Musculoskeletal and Skin Diseases at the National Institutes of Health, and I'm delighted to moderate this session on health disparities and the intersection of science, policy, and practice. We're going to start with our keynote speaker, Dr. David Williams, who is the Florence and Laura Norman Professor of Public Health and Professor of African and African American Studies and of Sociology at Harvard University. Dr. Williams has a long-term interest in social influences on health and has studied and published extensively on the trends and determinants of socioeconomic and racial differences in health. He is a true citizen of academia as well as of the public in serving on many Institute of Medicine programs, NIH programs, as well as throughout the public's media. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Williams, who will be talking about social and economic policies for reducing health disparities.
Thank you, and it's good to be here with you today and to take part in this historic conference. We have a lot of territory to cover, so I'll jump right into my talk and emphasize that I want to do two things in my talk. The really main thing is to highlight the fact that there is a growing body of scientific evidence, evidence of the highest quality that points to the important solutions and steps we need to take in terms of addressing disparities. But before I do that, I want to highlight briefly some of the contours of disparities so we have a clear sense of the challenge that is facing us. What's that? I'm trying to get the technology working here. Okay, my title is Moving Upstream, How Interventions That Address the Social Determinants of Health Can Improve Health and Reduce Disparities. I acknowledge this is the title of a recently published paper, and I acknowledge my co-authors, two doctoral students at the Harvard School of Public Health, and Dr. Selena Mohammed from the University of Washington. So first point is that there's a large racial gap in health, with African Americans and American Indians having higher death rates than whites do in the early years. Latinos have comparable death rates or slightly higher at some of the younger ages. As we move to midlife, we see the persistence of a very large racial gaps in health, with the two groups having death rates either almost twice or twice as high as that of the white population, and that this pattern continues into late life. So from the cradle to the grave, we see large disparities. We need to understand the patterns of disparities that we see in the light of the contribution of immigration to health. Immigrants of all racial and ethnic groups do better in terms of health than their native-born counterparts. White immigrants have better health outcomes than whites born in the U.S. Black immigrants do better than blacks born in the U.S. Latinos and Asians do the same. And given the composition of Latino and Asian populations, their very good health profile must be understood in the context of these high levels of immigration. However, we see a striking pattern. I'm highlighting data by myself, work that I've done with two of the panelists here, that looks at the prevalence of psychiatric disorders by generational status. And you see for black Caribbean immigrants, for Latino immigrants, and for Asian immigrants, a worsening health with increasing generational status in the United States, with the pattern being most marked for that of black Caribbean immigrants. One of the major challenges we face in this area is to identify the relevant factors that are shaping this pronounced pattern we see of worsening health with increasing length of stay in the United States. Another way to say that, the data seems to suggest that the American way of life appears to be dangerous for your health. And so what interventions can we implement to reverse this downward trajectory of immigrants with increasing length of stay in the United States? A second pattern that exists in the data for groups that have been in the United States for a long time, where we have data for those groups, is the fact that disparities have persisted for a long time. We can see this with age-adjusted heart disease mortality rates. In 1950, there was no disparity between black and whites. Over time, both groups have improved, but whites have improved more rapidly than that of blacks, so there's a disparity today where there wasn't one in 1950. Cancer death rates tell a similar story. African Americans had lower death rates than whites from cancer in 1950, but more steep increases over time, so there's a large disparity today. For American Indians served by the Indian Health Service, we have data for that group, and just illustrating it with one outcome, diabetes mortality rates, we can see fairly stable rates for whites over time, but dramatic increases in diabetes mortality for American Indians. If we look at life expectancy at birth for blacks and whites over time, there were large disparities in 1900. We had made considerable progress by 1950, but have not made much progress in reducing the disparities since 1950 in overall life expectancy. What that means is that we should begin our conversation with disparities by recognizing that they've existed for a long time. As a society, we've tried many things to address them, but as a whole, we have not been very successful. We have failed. We've had a war on poverty, a civil rights revolution, Medicaid and Medicare, the Hill-Burton Act that provided access to acute hospital beds. We lead the world in medical spending. We lead the world in medical spending on health care and on health research, but we have made little progress in reducing the striking disparities in health. What that means is that we cannot continue to do more of what we have been doing. What we have been doing has not worked. So we need to find a new path to addressing the problem of disparities. What might that new path be? What are the causes of these disparities? Let me highlight two of them before I talk about interventions. As a sociologist, I know that socioeconomic status is a powerful predictor of virtually everything in society. I illustrate that by looking at SAT scores by socioeconomic status. You see with every higher level of household income, SAT scores increase. That pattern that we see for SAT scores is also true for health. Socioeconomic status, as already been presented today, is one of the most powerful predictors of health, not just in the United States, but worldwide. There are large gaps in health by socioeconomic status, larger than even by cigarette smoking with all-cause mortality. And we need to understand the racial ethnic disparities in the light that socioeconomic status undergird them, because racial ethnic disparities reflects dramatic differences in socioeconomic status. Here is data on poverty by race ethnicity that tells the story. One important point to keep in mind is that there are twice as many poor whites in the United States than poor Latinos, twice as many poor whites than poor African Americans. So when we talk about the problem of socioeconomic status and the problem of poverty, we are talking about the entire population, and we really need to think of issues that affect the entire population. Here is national data on premature mortality, that's deaths before age 60. By income levels, and you can see that persons of low income in the United States are three times more likely to die prematurely than persons of high income. However, we must acknowledge that there is an added burden of race. The racial disparities in health cannot be reduced simply to socioeconomic status, although socioeconomic status is a driving force behind them. I'll give you a couple pictures that illustrate that. Here is national data looking at the percent of persons in fair or poor health by race ethnicity, and you can see the differences by race ethnicity. The largest difference is the 8% difference between blacks and whites. If you look at that same data broken down by income levels, you can see that whites, African Americans, and Latinos, for all three groups, there are much larger gaps by socioeconomic status, by income in this case, than by race ethnicity. In fact, the gaps within each racial group or ethnic group is about three times larger than the overall racial difference. And we need to focus on this centrality of socioeconomic status. But let's talk about the added burden of race. Here is infant death rates in the United States for blacks and whites. And you can see as mothers' education increases, infant death rates decline. But here you see this striking pattern that the most advantaged African-American women, black women with a college degree or more education, have a higher rate of infant mortality than white women, Asian women, Latino women who have not completed high school. So there is a dramatic excess burden of race, added factors linked to race that are driving these disparities that we need to understand. Research is pursuing three different areas in understanding these disparities. I'll just mention them today and will not spend much time talking about them. First is the non-equivalence of socioeconomic status across race. What do we mean by that? We mean that all of our traditional indicators of socioeconomic status do not mean the same thing in each racial groups. So, for example, blacks receive less income at the same levels of education, have less wealth at equivalent levels of income, have less purchasing power, given that the cost of goods and services are higher in the places where they live, so that these indicators don't really capture the same thing in each racial group. The second point is we need to think of socioeconomic status in a life course perspective. Individuals are affected not only by their current socioeconomic status, but by their exposures over the life course. And the inadequacies in income, in deprivation, in nutrition, and medical care early in life have long-term consequences. And thirdly, we need to understand the contribution of racism at the institutional level, at the interpersonal level, to the racial disparities in health that we see. What can we do about these disparities in health? Well, the Surgeon General's report, 1979, we can quibble with the numbers, but I think they're in the general ballpark that we can think of, suggests that 50% of differences, variations in health among adults is driven by behavior, 10% by medical care, 20% by genetics, 20% by the environment, which means that we need to address problems of inequities in health care. We need to improve access to care for all. We need to improve the quality of care for all. We need to give emphasis to the prevention of illness and provide effective treatment. And we need to find ways to reduce the inequalities in the quality of care that have been well documented in reports such as the Unequal Treatment Report. But probably much more importantly, we need to provide care that addresses the context of people's lives. Effective care must deal not only with the organ system, but with the context of individuals' lives. And the more that we can take this broader perspective, the more research suggests we can effectively address the health challenges of individuals. One example, and there are multiple studies, but one example is the nurse-family partnership. We now have three randomized controlled trials that shows that providing this more intensive, this more comprehensive level of care to pregnant women improves outcomes for those women and for their children. Importantly, in the nurse-family partnership, the control group received comprehensive prenatal care and transportation vouchers to get to care. So what the contribution of this program was, the added advantage of sending nurses to the home, visiting those mothers, and dealing not only with their health concerns, but much broadly with all of the other concerns of their lives. And we have the highest quality of scientific evidence suggesting not only that the program works, but it's cost-effective. It's a good investment for our society. But we need to also make behavioral changes. Americans need to reduce smoking levels and improve nutrition and reduce obesity. We need to increase exercise, reduce alcohol misuse, improve sexual health, and improve mental health. How can we change behaviors? I think what we have learned over the last 100 years is just say no campaigns alone is not enough. Interventions narrowly focused on health behaviors are likely to be ineffective. What we need are broad interventions to address the fundamental determinants that drive individuals' health. If we look at what has happened with smoking as a success story, it has taken the contribution of many organizations working through multiple intervention channels to inform the public through multiple mechanisms, to provide economic inducements to reduce tobacco smoke, and also laws and regulations. The point is, it's multiple sectors of society working together, and even with all of that, we've only been partially effective. The important point is that to reduce inequalities in health and to make more progress than we've made before, we must address the fundamental non-medical determinants of health that drive the health we see. We need to move upstream. We need policies to reduce inequalities in health that address these non-medical factors. Why? Because where we live, learn, work, and play and worship has more to do with our health than access to medical care. Medical care is important, but medical care is important, but medical care is a repair shop. It takes care of us when we get sick. What I'm talking about today is what helps us to become healthy in the first place. Social policies make it easier or harder for us to make healthy choices. So we need to redefine health policy to include under the rubric of health policy policies in all sectors of society that affect opportunities to choose health, including housing policy and employment policy and community development policy and transportation policy and income support policies. All of these are health policies. What are some specific things that we can do, and what evidence do we have that these things work? First, we need to address the problems linked to place. Geography is a huge predictor of opportunity in American society and a huge predictor of health outcomes. You can see this by looking at Indian reservations. You can see this by looking at the high levels of residential segregation in the United States. What this shows, in the year 2000, most of America's major cities were only slightly less segregated than South Africa was under legally mandated apartheid in 1991. Why does segregation matter? David Cutler and his colleagues showed that if we could eliminate the effect of segregation in the United States, you would completely erase black-white differences in income, in education and unemployment, and reduce black-white differences in single motherhoods by two-thirds. All of that driven by residential segregation. William Julius Wilson and Robert Sampson concluded that the worst urban context in which whites reside in the 171 largest cities in the United States is considerably better than the average context of black communities. Recently, Dolores Acevedo Garcia and I published a paper in which we looked at what's the impact of segregation on poor kids in the United States. And we asked the simple question, what percentage of black and minority kids live in worse conditions than the worst off white kids? So they decide the quintile of white kids that did worse in residential conditions. And we found that in all metro areas, 76% of African-American kids and 69% of Latino kids were doing worse than the worst off white kids in the United States. And these levels were even higher in highly segregated metropolitan areas. What can we do about segregated areas, about the quality of poor life in areas? There is good research now from the Moving Opportunity Program, for example, that randomized families that found that improving neighborhood quality with no intervention in health led to improved health. The Yonkers Housing Intervention also showed that improving neighborhood quality led to improved health. There are also studies from outside the United States that show the same thing. We also have evidence that reducing poverty, improving living standards, enhancing income with no health intervention leads to improved health. A study done, very carefully done experimental design in the 1970s showed that providing mothers additional income led to improved birth weights for their children. A natural experiment found that providing American Indian households additional income led to improved outcomes for the children. The New Hope experiment in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, also found that by providing additional income to households, helping them to improve their living standards, led to improvement in both educational and health outcomes. The conditional cash transfer program from Latin America also document that providing low-income communities and households additional income leads to improved health for income. So we have evidence, is my point. We also have dramatic evidence of the economic impact of the civil rights movement that had ripple effects on health. In the last 50 years, as a result of the gains of the civil rights movement, in the 10 years after the civil rights movement, the health of blacks improved. There was a narrowing of the gap in disparities between 1968 and 1978, as we saw some of the ripple effects of improved economic status for blacks as a result of the gains of the civil rights movement. But what happened in the wake of those impressive gains during the 1980s, the income of blacks declined relative to that of whites. You could see blacks earned 59 cents for every dollar whites earned in 1978, and that level was not achieved at any year during the 1980s. And what data shows is that as the economic status of African Americans declined, their health also declined. For 5 years in a row after 1984, the life expectancy of African Americans absolutely declined. I'm not talking about a relative decline. I'm talking about an absolute decline. Worsening economic circumstances leads to worsening health. We need to think about that in the current economic environment in which we live. Evidence also indicates that education matters. Investments in early childhood programs have decisive benefits for the well-being, the educational performance, the educational success of children, as well as for their health. There's growing body of evidence that shows that the brain circuits in fetal and early childhood periods are affected by exposure to stress. And when infants are exposed to toxic stress, they have there's damage to the brain architecture that makes them incapable of functioning, of learning well, of achieving the socioeconomic status that would put them on a path to good health. So when Johnny can't read in grade one, it's not that Johnny just has behavioral problems, but his brain has been damaged by the toxic stress that he has faced. We can do more to reduce the stress that children face. The Perry High School project gives us an example, high-quality experimental evidence that shows that by providing poor households in a low-income Perry School neighborhood and intervention in early childhood, we have seen dramatic effects 40 years later. Those who received the program had higher levels of education. They had higher levels of income, higher rates of home ownership, higher rates of savings. Those who received the program were less involved with the criminal justice system. And the program is economically effective. For every $1 invested in the program, there's a $17 return. Where can you find those kinds of returns? And that also ensures the future of our children. I want to note that as we try to address the problems of inequalities, and I don't have time to elaborate on this, we could talk about this for an hour, we need to think of the resources that communities have and individuals have and work with them by building on their resources. I also want to say that there are many resources out there for public health officials and workers and researchers to help address these problems. One of them is the Commission to Build a Healthy America that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has funded. I'm serving as a staff director with Wilhelmine Miller, Paula Braveman, the research director, working with two communications firms. We are seeking to raise awareness levels to the policymaking community in this country and the engaged public. We are planning April 2 of next year to have a report with policy interventions, both public and private, to address the problems, and we certainly want to communicate to the American public that something can be done. This commission is led by two very distinguished leaders, Mark McClellan and Alice Rivlin, who have served the country well, a broad range of commissioners who bring their expertise from broad domains of life and excellence to the commission. And the Commission's website has a broad range of resources that will be effective for public health officials. We have a booth here at the convention that you can get more resources from and get concretely some resources, commissiononhealth.org. The basic message that this commission is trying to bring forward is that there is more to health than health care. And we need to move beyond the conversation of medical care and affordability and personal responsibility and access and coverage. All of these are important, but these are not sufficient. We also need to think of living and working conditions in homes and communities and opportunities and resources to broadly address the problems of inequalities we address. The MacArthur Network on Socioeconomic Status that I belong to has also issued an important report on facts and socioeconomic status and what you can do to improve health. You can download a PDF from the website. This is a group headed by Nancy Adler, includes Michael Marmot, and a range of other outstanding researchers that have put their best minds together. And then there's the Unnatural Causes series, another wonderful resource that community leaders can use to provide resources to address health. I want to conclude by making the point that we have come in this country to a time for action. We now know what it takes to build a healthy America. We can reduce socioeconomic inequalities in health. We know enough to act. We can build a healthy America where every child can develop normally, free from poverty, abuse, and neglect. We can build a healthy America where every child can be ready for academic success when they begin school and have access to school environments that support academic, emotional, and physical well-being. We can build a healthy America where we can breathe clean air that is free from tobacco and other pollutants. We can build a healthy America where everyone has opportunities to be physically active. We can build a healthy America where everyone has access to food and ability to obtain nutritious food. We can build a healthy America where everyone has access to high-quality, affordable housing. We can build a healthy America where everyone lives in well-maintained neighborhoods that are safe and that have access to appropriate goods and services. We can build a healthy America where everyone has received the training and skills to create business opportunities and to obtain a decent job that pays a living wage. We can build a healthy America where everyone can work in healthy occupational environments free from physical or chemical exposures that are harmful to health. We can build a healthy America where everyone has access to reliable, safe, affordable, and accessible means of public or private transportation. We can build a healthy America where everyone has access to high-quality medical care. We can build a healthy America where everyone has equitable opportunities and is hopeful and optimistic about the future. Yes, we can. Let me conclude this morning. Thank you. Health officials and organizations cannot improve health by themselves. Improving health is not just the work of public health officials. Improving health and reducing inequalities is not just about more programs, but it's about a new path to health. All policy that affects health is health policy. Health officials need to work collaboratively with other sectors of society to initiate and support policies that promote health and reduce inequalities in health. Inequalities in health didn't just happen. They were explicitly created by social policy, and it will take new social policies to implement a new path and a new direction for this country. Eliminating disparities, most importantly, it requires political will and a commitment to new strategies to improve our living and working conditions. Yes, we need research, but our greatest need is systematically and comprehensively to use the knowledge that we have. And now is the time. Edmund Burke said, "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men and women to do nothing." I believe we are good people. We can work together to improve the health of all Americans.
How wonderful was that? I'm delighted I'm not the next speaker. But our next speaker does bring an enormous experience to us, Dr. Meredith Minkler, who is professor of health and social behavior at the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley. She has vast experience in working with underserved communities in community building and community-based participatory research. Dr. Minkler.
Would anyone like to come forward and follow Dr. Williams? Okay. Well, it really is a pleasure and a real honor to be part of the summit and to follow Dr. Williams, who did such an outstanding job of making the case for refocusing our efforts in health disparities much farther upstream. And he provided us, too, with highlights of a growing and rigorous evidence base that reminds us that the limits of the possible in this area may be a lot less constraining than we have tended to believe. I've been asked to address the intersections of science, practice, and policy in health disparities work from the perspective of community-based participatory research, which, as Nina Wallerstein made clear in her excellent presentation, talks not about a research method or a set of methods, but rather an orientation to research fueled by collaboration that begins with systematic inquiry, but then uses the research process as a springboard for action to help address health disparities. I think the rationale for CBPR is best captured in this cartoon, which really speaks to the gigantic disconnect between academic research and the real concerns of people in their neighborhoods. Participatory research can help address this problem in part because it attends to health disparities concerns that matter locally, but also because a hallmark of this approach is its commitment to action as part of the research process, not something we leave for somebody else to do after the fact. That action, of course, can take many forms, as we've heard today. But if we're going to influence the lives of large numbers of people, we increasingly are seeing action on the policy level as absolutely central. My colleague Nick Freudenberg makes a good point when he says that changing policy provides an intermediate level of action that transcends the limitations of individual and community-level work while offering more immediate health payoffs than the distant and difficult structural changes that also are needed. And he shares as an example the work of the Harlem Urban Research Center and its policy work group, a diverse group of providers, residents, former inmates, and others who together have worked to study and address the fact that for over half of the 100,000 inmates that are released from New York City jails and prisons every year and who are disproportionately African American and Latino, it's not a one-way trip. They're back in jail within a year. Members of the policy work group did secondary data analysis of public use data sets on substance use and incarceration. They did focus groups with dozens of substance users and former inmates in Harlem. They surveyed local providers. They did public opinion poll research. And through all these various means, I'm trying to get there, yes. Through all of these various means, they uncovered 11 existing policies that completely mitigated against community reintegration. Policies, for example, like one terminating Medicaid coverage upon incarceration rather than simply suspending it until release, thereby effectively preventing ex-offenders from immediately getting the medication, the treatment they need to be able to cope and not go back to jail. By studying this policy and documenting that having Medicaid in the year after release can reduce the risk of incarceration or reincarceration by two-thirds, Dr. Freudenberg and his colleagues were well positioned to then use that work to advocate to the legislature and to the governor to change this harmful policy. They also used some of their findings to persuade the Department of Corrections to curtail the ridiculous practice of letting most inmates out in the middle of the night. And they also used their findings on cost savings and so on to help get legislation passed mandating discharge planning, mandating help with housing and with getting jobs immediately upon release. Well, the Harlem URC case study is just one of 10 across the country that my colleagues and I at UC Berkeley and PolicyLink have studied as part of a broader effort to try to document how CBPR may be contributing to policy change that in turn can promote health and reduce health disparities. And if you'd like to read more about this, we've posted the report on our PolicyLink's website. And there's a copy. I brought about 50 copies with me if people want a hard copy as well. Unfortunately, though, and unlike the elegant studies that Dr. Williams shared with us, there are no randomized controlled trials that can demonstrate the impacts of CBPR on policy. But through in-depth multi-method case study analysis, including interviews with a number of policymakers around the country, we have been able, I think, to get a unique window into the ways in which these efforts appear to have made a difference. Let me give you a couple of other examples and then briefly summarize some of the lessons we've learned about how CBPR can serve as a vehicle for linking science, practice, and policy. Some of the best CBPR to address health disparities has been in the area of environmental justice. And although the program has now ended, I really want to give a word of credit to NIEHS for being the first institute within NIH to begin back in 1995 a sustained funding effort in CBPR. One of the best known environmental justice collaboratives that was funded through that mechanism began when West Harlem Environmental Action, or WEACT, contacted the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health about their interest in studying whether the very high rates of asthma among kids in their neighborhoods — we estimate that one in four children in Harlem, preschoolers, have asthma — whether those high rates might be related, in fact, to the fact that northern Manhattan was home to 7 of the 8 diesel bus depots, housing thousands of the buses that serve the rest of the city. It was home to 650 Port Authority buses, to 200 sanitation trucks, and so forth. But in addition to the science, they wanted to translate the findings into policy change that would create equity in environmental decision-making and environmental protection. And this second goal is absolutely critical, because it's a reminder that if we're going to eliminate health disparities, we need to be concerned not only with distributive justice, but also with procedural justice, through which people of color, people from other marginalized groups, get a seat at the policy table and get to stay at the table. Thank you. Through this collaboration, WEACT youth interns were trained by epidemiologists at Columbia to do GIS mapping and to calibrate and wear backpack air monitors while doing vehicle and pedestrian counts at key intersections for 5 8-hour days, always under the supervision of the scientists. Their research showed levels of exposure to fine particulate matter that were far above the EPA's standard, with variations related to the magnitude of local diesel sources. At WEAC's urging, the EPA then used ambient air monitors in these very same hotspots, and their findings closely mirrored those of the WEAC study. While the study findings were making their way into academic journals, WEAC and its partners were creating awareness through a broad-based public education campaign with the tagline, "If you live uptown, breathe at your own risk." Study results were made accessible to community members through articles and local newsletters. And I have to say, I love this line by Dennis Raphael: if an article appears in Social Science and Medicine but nobody reads it, does it exist? WEACT was also working to get on the political agenda, which John Kingdon refers to as the set of issue areas to which policymakers are paying attention. They did this by laying out very clear, concise policy goals, identifying targets capable of responding, and using a whole multitude of methods, obviously including things like briefings and testimony, but also co-sponsoring an alternative fuel summit, doing media advocacy, conducting toxics and treasures tours for policymakers. Let them see Harlem and the problems, but also let them see all the historic sites, all of the things that make this such an important contributor to our culture. They also joined in the filing of a legal complaint under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. Well, what were the outcomes? Several policymakers that we interviewed, along with documents review and other data sources, indicated that WEACT and its partners played a substantial role in achieving several outcomes, among them the transit authority's conversion of the entire fleet to clean diesel, EPA's initiation of permanent community-based air monitoring in Harlem and other hotspots around the country, the youth intern study, which was presented at EPA hearings, played a major role in getting tighter air quality standards, which have stood up to all legal appeals. And New York adopted a statewide environmental justice policy, which WEACT helped initiate. And while they've remained focused on their signature issue, co-sponsoring hearings on the health impacts of the bus operations, WEACT and its partners have taken on other issues like mold as a contributor to indoor air pollution, climate change, and efforts to promote the greening of New York City with special attention to areas like Harlem. Well, the WEACT partnership, in short, is a good example of how strong science combined with effective community-based advocacy can help bring about change on the policy level while at the same time laying the groundwork for more research, more action, and hopefully more good policy. The last case study I want to share with you briefly illustrates the fact that CBPR can help address health disparities when the problem isn't what people are exposed to, but what they're not exposed to. In this case, healthy food. When a partnership between the San Francisco Department of Public Health and local community group, Literacy for Environmental Justice in Bayview Hunters Point, did a community survey. They indicated lack of access to nutritious food as one of the greatest concerns in this neighborhood, which, like so many, has no supermarket and a lot of stores that look just like this and call themselves food stores. Ledge youth were trained to do store shelf diagramming to determine how much space was currently devoted to different types of products. And here you see the results. In the 11 corner stores, almost 40% of the space goes to packaged food, 26% to alcohol and tobacco, 17% to sodas, just 2 to 5% for healthy food. Through GIS mapping and the collection of additional survey data, the partnership learned that it takes the average resident 1 hour and 3 bus rides to get from their home to the nearest full-serve grocery store. And not surprisingly, they found that under these circumstances, fully a quarter have at least one fast food meal every day. They surveyed local residents and found out, among other things, what it would take to get them to shop locally instead of taking $2 million worth of business out of the neighborhood every year. They interviewed local merchants to find out what it would take them to stock more healthy food. And then, based on their findings and on an economic feasibility study, which they also helped with, and working very closely with a city supervisor, they crafted a voluntary policy, the Good Neighbor Program, and got several city departments to endorse it. The idea here was to incentivize local stores by providing them things like free advertising, discounted loans, energy-efficient appliances, if they agreed to certain things like devoting a minimum of 10% of their space to healthy food, removing outdoor cigarette and alcohol ads, and so forth. This is one of the award-winning ads that now appears throughout Bayview Hunters Point, urging people to patronize these Good Neighbor stores. And the program appears to have had some real success. The first store to officially adopt the Good Neighbor program saw in the first 7 months an increase from 5 to 15% in the percent of total sales that came from fresh produce. Their alcohol and tobacco sales went down 10%, and their overall profits went up 15%. This has continued. 2007, I didn't want to call them after the economic downturn. I still have to do that. But as of last fall, their profits were still up, their alcohol and tobacco sales still down 10%, and their produce sales were still up dramatically. They have, as a result, in part of this initial success, 4 other corner stores have adopted the Good Neighbor program. 5 more are underway, thanks to additional funding from the California Endowment. And they've acquired a truck, so they're now taking the healthy produce out to the Bayview schools and to the homes. The Ledge Partnership also, and I think most excitingly, has provided some of the impetus and support for an assembly bill which would take the program to scale through a statewide demonstration program that was passed and signed into law in 2006, unfortunately without a budgetary appropriation. And now in our economic climate, particularly in California, I don't see Arnold doing this for us, but it could happen. My time's almost up, so I want to conclude by offering you some take-home messages from the lessons we've learned based on this study. Getting to policy and practice through CBPR requires, first and foremost, relevant, credible data and science that can stand up to careful scrutiny. Where possible, it ought to involve a variety of research methods. Quantitative data obviously are important for moving policymakers, but so are people's stories captured in the qualitative data. I love this line by Vic Seidel, that statistics are the people with the tears washed off. Policymakers want the stories, too. Getting from science to policy also requires building leadership and a strong base of support by being genuinely community-driven and starting where the people are, with ideas and health disparities issues that they're committed to enough to want to study and want to mobilize around. And it means demystifying the policy process using tools like a wonderful book by Makani Temba. I'm having trouble going back here. Okay, yeah, Makani Temba, who I think is here, wrote a wonderful book, Making Policy, Making Change. Cassandra Ritas has a wonderful workbook for community partners in CBPR, Speaking Truth to Power. It's available on the ccph.org, the Community Campus Partnerships for Health website. We also, Nina Wallerstein and I, in the second edition of our CBPR book, include in the appendix a number of tools like this power mapping exercise that community and academic partners can go through together as they try to demystify some of these pieces of the policymaking puzzle. Getting to policy also means a commitment to doing our homework, finding out what other communities have done. Who holds the decision-making authority? What are the key leverage points? And what sorts of policy-relevant data need to be collected now, from whom, and how? This is all part of the data collection process. At the same time, we need to be building strong collaborations and alliances with numerous stakeholders beyond the formal partnership. And we're increasingly seeing that legislators, regulators, administrators may later be key to getting a policy or practice in place. There are, of course, lots of challenges in this work, among them the tightrope walk involved in balancing what Price and Behrens call the necessary skepticism of science and the action imperative of communities. There may be tensions in talking about policy goals and policy impacts due to real or perceived funding constraints. And we saw this especially in partnerships with NIH funding. They worry about this. It was certainly the case in a wonderful partnership between Concerned Citizens and Tillery and UNC faculty and students, who have done a wonderful job of studying the rapid proliferation of industrialized hog farms, hog factories, rather, in North Carolina. That partnership used spatial analysis, water sampling, survey research. Their research showed, among other things, the disproportionate location of these hog factories in predominantly low-income African-American communities, even after adjusting for population density. Well, they had used this research, along with advocacy, coalition building, organizing, to bring about a number of policy changes, most recently including a 2007 moratorium on new hog factory construction and higher standards for waste management. But when I interviewed the lead community partner about his role in this and the policy that they'd tried to work on, he said over and over again with a wink and a smile, "We don't do policy, we just educate legislators." This guy had twice appeared on 60 Minutes, but he doesn't do policy. Academic partners may find, too, that CBPR's commitment to using science to promote practice and policy runs into roadblocks, as those presented by some of our leading academic journals. I'll never get to publish again in epidemiology after I tell you this, but the instructions to authors for that journal clearly say that they discourage policy recommendations in research papers. Save it for the commentary. Well, if you're in CBPR, you've got a commitment to making a policy recommendation. Finally, as Nina suggested, we've got to figure out how to measure the long-term impacts of this work on the policy and practice level. And I would add, we've got to do it once the money has run out, once the formal partnership may have ended. To their credit, the Harlem URC and their policy work group kept meeting monthly for years after their biggest source of funding ended, and it was during that post-grant period that they saw real successes in getting a number of their policy goals enacted. Well, let me bring this full circle by saying that we, of course, need major structural changes to eliminate health disparities. As Dr. Williams made clear so eloquently, we also need bold scientific studies using randomized control trials to make the case for moving much further upstream. But at the same time, CBPR that begins with locally identified issues can be a potent strategy for linking community-based work and good science with healthier public policy, and in the process, helping to support both the distributive justice and the procedural justice that are so necessary for eliminating health disparities. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that excellent presentation. We all applaud the work that you've done and that you've brought to the table. Our next speaker is Dr. Margarita Alegria. She's a professor at Harvard, and she's the director of the Multicultural Research at the Cambridge Health Alliance. She's received numerous awards and much recognition for her long-term commitment to researching disparities in mental health and substance abuse services for Latinos and other minority communities. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Alegria.
Well, I want to welcome, I feel very welcome in this audience. I mean, a lot of the people here have been doing disparities research for a long, long time. It's not a fad. These are the people in the trenches, and I think I feel very welcome in it. I want to first start thanking Dr. Ruffin and Dr. Tsai for this historic event. I think it really shows that the tide is changing, that equity is coming to the forefront, and I think that's very important. I also want to make sure that I dedicate this speech to the people that are working for us, the program officers. And I specifically want to name three that are really the link between the researchers and the institutes. I want to talk about Nathan Stinson, Cheryl Boyce, and Carmen Moten, who have made our life so much easier. I'm going to be talking mostly about practice because I actually think that very little of the work we do really goes down to where people are working with our patients, with minority patients, and try to find out what's going wrong, what's really there. I mean, we have big, ambitious agendas. This is a fairly low, ambitious agenda of trying to help providers that are in safety net clinics do a better job. The IOM report actually presented a paradox. They presented the paradox of how could well-meaning and highly educated health professionals working in their usual circumstances with diverse populations show a pattern that looked to be discriminatory. What was going on? And actually, this is really the focus of this presentation. What is going on that these people that are usually a self-selected group that is very interested in the well-being of patients could show a pattern that seems to be discriminatory? What we see is that if you think about healthcare and the intersection between a patient and a provider, what we see is that it's an interpretation of an interpretation. On the one hand, most treatment is dependent on a patient being able to describe what's their experience, what are they feeling. And if you think about it, both signs and symptoms are culturally constructed, so they can be very different for different cultures. At the same time, we have to have a provider, a clinician, that has the ability to accurately comprehend the patient's language and the embodiment of that experience, and actually translate it and give it meaning to then assign it a diagnosis. But if you think about it, that's also a culturally constructed experience. So you have two people trying to translate the experience of the patient-provider interaction, but maybe with very different focus and agendas in terms of their cultural construction. So the motivation for this study is actually to try to see the existence of diagnostic bias. This is really why providers make systematic errors in both the collection and processing of information that could lead to misdiagnosis or false positives or false negatives. And really, what we're trying to try to see here is how could we reduce diagnostic bias, with the idea that diagnostic bias is very important for actually treatment, getting good quality care, and also for reducing service disparities and outcomes. Let me tell you a little bit about this study, because this study was done in naturalistic settings. very different than the studies that have been done previously. This study was work done behind the scenes. We actually went to safety net clinics to try to see how providers and patients interact, how providers collect information, how they process that information that could lead to diagnostic bias. At the same time, we were interested in trying to work with the clinicians, different than other studies that come and tell clinicians what they should not do. We really wanted to understand clinicians and see with clinicians what could be improved. So the goal of this study is really, of this presentation, is to describe how diagnostic bias might take place while assessing minority patients, and then what can we do to improve it. Let me tell you a little bit about the methods of this study. The patient-provider encounter study was the courageous effort of 129 patients and providers interviews that patients and providers courageously agreed to have us videotape. So we videotape those patients coming for the first time to a clinical interview, a mental health clinical interview with their providers. We put a camera after consent, obviously, and left the office of the provider. We saw what the interaction was. We videotaped that interaction with no one in the room, and then after they finished that clinical intake, we went out. And separately, the provider and the patient were separately interviewed to try to see their experience in care and how they felt with that clinical interview. After that, we actually had survey information collected from both the provider and the patient to try to understand what was going on and also see what they felt were their perceptions of each other. After that, we had a clinician that separately saw the videotape of that patient and provider interaction, and blind to whatever the provider had said, gave a separate diagnosis for that patient. Let me tell you who were our patients in the study. The patients were evenly distributed in terms of gender. Their age was mostly fairly young population between the ages of 18 to 49. They were overwhelmingly Latino. These were safety net clinics in the Northeast. They had a range of education between less than 11 years to 13 years to 15 years of education. 46% were employed, and 64% had an income of less than $15,000, and most were Medicaid. In terms of the providers were overwhelmingly women, fairly young, between the ages of 35 to 49, mostly white providers, and evenly distributed between psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers, with a range of experience in terms of their clinical experience. Let me tell you a little bit of the results that what I want to share with you. This is the experience that any of us could have in a clinical encounter for a mental health intake. What we find, first of all, is that providers in their provider interviews talk about how difficult it is to prioritize sometimes what they have to do. On the one hand, they have to engage the patient, build rapport, and at the same time, they have to come up with a mental health status diagnosis. And this is fairly difficult. For some, they mention having to do a safety assessment of the patient, and at the same time, really coming up with a treatment plan for that patient. So they really are juggling a lot of agendas at the same time. At the same time, people have talked about the way to deal with diagnostic bias is using symptom checklists, what Paul Neal called the actuarial approach. The actuarial approach is you basically ask a lot of symptoms to the patient and actually get the information the same for everyone independently of their ethnicity or race. Well, guess what? Providers told us this is a description of a provider telling us what happened after he used the symptom checklist with his patient. I got the sense that he wanted to, you know, have the kind of, like, tell his story, and that just wasn't in the cards for today. Because we needed to fill out the intake so I could tell that he was unpleased, that, you know, I will be interrupting him and asking him all these questions. You know, he said at the end he didn't feel that he could really talk to me, that sometimes he didn't think I was listening. And actually, this patient never came back. What we find is when providers actually go through a symptom checklist and really try to collect a lot of clinical information, they lose the patient. I also want to tell you a little bit about computers and how providers need to now fill in so much information on computers. This is one provider, and as you can see, people have to lose the contact, the eye contact with the patient. And what does this make for the patient? What is the feeling that it evokes in a patient to be completely disconnected from someone that they're opening their hearts and guts? The other thing we found in this study, which is fairly scary, is that the two providers had very low agreement in terms of what was the diagnosis of that person. In other words, if you look, there was greater agreement if the person had a substance diagnosis, but there was very low agreement if people had either an anxiety disorder or a depression disorder, with people not really the two providers that saw the patient coming up with very different diagnoses for the patient. Particularly if you ask what was the specific diagnosis. This means that people, that providers are going to weight the information that you report differently. The other thing we found is that although providers in general term ask about general information about symptoms, about depression symptoms, about anxiety symptoms, and about substance abuse symptoms, the information is just a general screener. Something like, have you been sad? Or have you been anxious in the last 2 weeks? And that's about it. That's really about it, what they can ask. We also found that for most providers, they really rely on very general information about depression, about anxiety, to make their diagnosis. But I also, another aspect that we saw is that the lack of agreement within providers had to do with the differences in really assessing completely the full criteria for a patient versus not. And in both of these areas, we found, as you can see here with white, Latino, and black patients that endorse a screener, that it's very unlikely that they would continue to assess the full criteria for the disorder. Therefore, a lot of information is going to be missing from these patients. Different than what we saw with the diagnostic information, providers actually ask a lot of the information about the life circumstances of patients. They ask a lot about, you know, what were the living conditions, what was the family history, what was the treatment history of patients. In other words, they really wanted to know who the patient was. This is a provider telling us how important it is to trying to understand the patient. I would say my trying to understand the patient, not because it's guided by the DSM form or any other book, just because I wanted to understand the patient. I just started up an open-ended interview and asked her if she could sum it up a little bit, what would have been some of the main issues. And she took off and described at length the previous history of personal issues and how she had struggled with her life quite a bit. My main goal was to have a feeling for her. What are her main struggles? How does she cope with life? How does she find strength to do what she has to do? So to have a sense of her as a person, that was my goal. So that's the goal that providers are trying to engage in terms of learning about the patient. But here's where the disparity comes. The disparity came in terms that the information that gets collected is weighted differently depending on ethnicity. And even what is collected is different based on ethnicity and race. So there's a differential discussion of topic areas depending if you're white or you're Latino or you're African American. And that is important. Let me show you some data about differential areas of discussion of symptoms. For example, my discussion due to depression is more likely to be discussed if you're a Latino patient than if you're a white patient. The same thing seems to happen for exposure to a traumatic event. It's more likely to be discussed with a Latino patient than with a white patient. While obsessions or inability to cut alcohol intake or recurrent substance use or trouble with the police are more likely to be asked if you're a white patient. So as you're coming through the door, the provider also assesses what sort of information they're going to collect. But not only is the difference in terms of the information that gets collected, but also how this information gets weighted. And let me give you a few examples. For example, Latino who has discussions of family history of abuse or victimization and disability were more likely to be given a depression diagnosis than if a white person came, discussed exactly the same similar events, they were less likely to be given a depression diagnosis. Same thing happened with symptoms of anxiety and being Latino. We found that they had an increased likelihood of receiving an anxiety disorder with the same symptoms presented by a white patient, less likely to get an anxiety disorder. So what we find in terms of diagnostic bias is that clinicians really have a lot of missing information. They're really limited by the patient in letting the patient tell their story. And because they're letting the patient tell their story, they are only allowed to ask some screener information, some general information. And once the actuarial approach really cannot be used, because as you saw here, most providers that use a symptom checklist actually got rejected by the patient. The patient said, this person doesn't listen to me. They really don't care who I am. Didn't come back. It appears, therefore, that clinicians, to optimize the time they have with the patient, with this minority patient, really rely on very general descriptions of depression, anxiety, or substance use to identify the disorders without really assessing specific information or the full criteria. As a result, with this limited information, they have to make decisions about what's the diagnosis of the patient, and they make a lot of those decisions weighting the information differently for Latinos, African Americans, and whites. This differential discussion of topic areas and differential weighting of information is going to lead to diagnostic bias. And now we are in the process of trying to work with clinicians. How do we move from this problem to a solution? What we have been doing is basically going back to clinicians and presenting the information and trying to generate with them what are the likely interventions that are going to work in safety net clinics. We're very worried of giving the same sort of approaches of just giving recommendations without recommendations that fit the actual context of where clinicians are working. So the idea now is to go back to them and see what fits in their environment. As a result, we're also trying to identify four or five different pros that are quick, that could be used independently of the race, ethnicity of the patient, to try to collect this information without disrupting the flow of what the patient needs to say and narrate their story. The other thing that we're trying to see, and this is more with administrators, has to do with the serious consideration of the time it's given to providers to do really the engagement and at the same time do the clinical diagnostic interview. Preparing the patient to be a better patient is also part of the agenda we have. And today I'll be discussing in the 1 o'clock meeting sort of a patient activation and empowerment intervention that we have developed in the Center for Multicultural Research tied to how to help patients become better informers and also better demanders of what they want. But together I think helping finding interventions that fit the actual circumstances of the people that provide services to our populations is really central, and that's our next step. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that very interesting presentation. Our final speaker today is Dr. David Takeuchi. He is a professor in the Department of Sociology in the School of Social Work at the University of Washington, and also serves as the interim director of the University of Washington's Research Institute in Diversity. He is a sociologist and investigates social, structural, and cultural aspects of different health outcomes, especially among racial and ethnic minorities. Today he's going to talk to us about creating, maintaining, and blurring the boundaries of science, policy, and practice. Dr. Takeuchi.
Well, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be at this historic conference in this historic year. And being last on the panel and being with this distinguished group of scholars, it would be easy for me to just say I agree and leave, but I won't. But I also realize that we're getting close to lunch, we're getting close to the final speaker, and I know many of you are quite weary from all the wonderful information you've been gaining from this morning. And I promised my wife that I would not resort to any cheap tricks to keep your amusement or to maintain your interest. So let me begin. With my dog. My wife has a wicked sense of humor, and she took the first two letters of my first and last name and combined them and called him Data. And she said I would have a built-in excuse now to say that I'm working at home with my data or staying at home and playing with my data. And actually, with dogs, when you take them to walk, they leave some droppings, and that's called data collection. I'm also teaching him to fetch, and that's data retrieval. Anyway, I could go on and on, but I won't. I told this story to some students, and this one student came up to me after this talk, and she said, "Excuse me, but since it's only one dog, shouldn't it be Datum?" So I told her to get a life. Anyway, as David was talking, it reminded me of a column that Tom Friedman wrote, and I'm going to steal part of his anecdote. And he referred to the movie Jaws. And as they're first out on the fishing boat, they come into the first glimpse of this great white shark. And the Roy Scheider character turns to his other mates and says, "We're going to need a bigger boat." And David Williams' talk brings to mind the whole notion that we are going to need a bigger boat, bigger set of resources, and all of our are working together to come to grips to the problem of resolving health disparities. And one of his early statements is that we have failed and we haven't taken advantage of all of that come before us to resolve many of these disparities. And I'm going to talk about one thing this morning about how we have failed, both you and I, in resolving some of the boundaries that we have created and maintained in not moving the field as fast as it can or could have. I use the work of Tom Guerin, and he talks about boundaries, especially in the early part of the American society, but I think it has certainly contemporary implications. It begins with the notion that boundaries are socially constructed. And that's the good news and bad news. The good news is it is socially constructed, and we can have a strong input in resolving many of the kinds of boundaries that we have. The bad news is that it is socially constructed, and that we come to believe in the rigidity of these boundaries, and many of us resort to these as ideological battles that don't tend to resolve the immediate problem, keep us employed, but that does not move the field forward. Guerin also talks about the attribution of selected characteristics in maintaining this whole notion of science. Boundaries helps to maintain who are the practitioners within our own boundaries. What are the appropriate methods? What's the stock of knowledge or the body of knowledge that legitimizes each of these boundaries? And I'm going to give you some examples. And what are the values in the work organization of these boundaries? One of the main attempts of boundaries is to distinguish itself from non-science about what's legitimate science for these boundaries. Scientists set up these boundaries, both informally and formally, and they enlarge the material and symbolic resources of these different disciplines or professions. We defend these boundaries because it protects our own professional authority, and it lays claims to certain kinds of issues. What's legitimate for these disciplines and professions in terms of our own boundaries? Ideologies are often used to maintain these boundaries. I'm going to just mention two of these ways of looking at it. There's one called the strain theory, developed by Talcott Parsons, and it maintains that ideologies provide a ways to integrate conflicting demands, competing expectations, and deals with the ambiguities in social life. And this is a notion where things become a little unclear in life, and scientists often want to distinguish themselves from practitioners. And I think you can see a great example of this occurring in our recent economic crisis, where you see many of the people who've advocated for the policies that created the crisis now distancing themselves because they say, well, we didn't tell you how to implement them. We just had the theory. That creates this kind of distance between practitioners and scientists. There's also the notion of conflict theory, which Karl Marx had derived, in terms of ideologies are social levers or weapons used by groups to further their political economic interests for power and advantage. So we see the limited resources, or in some cases, the richness of the resources, and we create boundaries because we want our own professions or our disciplines to harness most of these resources. It creates a power struggle among a different discipline. One of the ways that boundaries are maintained is the rhetoric that we often use to promote these boundaries. There are the formal mechanisms, the reports we have, the scientific publications. Meredith provided a great way of capturing this when she said that one of the journals said we don't discuss policy recommendations in our articles. They're reserved for commentaries. So we develop these kinds of boundaries through our formal mechanisms. And then there are these kinds of informal mechanisms through comments, or I call them academic put-downs. And these are some of the examples. I'm sure you've heard them in some context. I heard this one last week when we were discussing the recruitment of faculty members. If we add or increase the diversity within our ranks, it will look like we lowered our standards within our own department. And then in some disciplines, I'll use mine in sociology. Those who focus on medical sociology are often called too applied. That is, we're not sociological enough. And it creates this boundary about what is sociology, or in some instances, what is anthropology and psychology. And there is often this split between certain segments within departments, and rhetoric is often used to create these kinds of ideologies. We've heard this quite often. Much of the disparities research is too ideological. It doesn't use any data. It doesn't have any data to support itself. And I think David Williams and Meredith and Maggie provide great examples about the lie behind those kinds of statements. But it's part of the ideology and rhetoric that we often use to separate the pure scientists from those who have application. One of the ways that we create this divide between academia and communities is that scientists often use the notion that communities can ruin the integrity of the scientific enterprise. So anyway, these are notions about how rhetoric can be used to maintain these kinds of ideological boundaries. Boundaries are inevitable. They're part of the process. Part of the problem is more the rigidity and the harm they can do and a recognition of what these boundaries are creating. One of the great examples in the literature I read is the tension between those who have focused on social class or race as explanations for different kinds of problems. One of the tensions is obvious between those who focus on policy studies or looking at poverty issues tend to publish in entirely different kinds of journals from those who focus on race. And the twain never meets, and we never make any kinds of meaningful interactions between the two sides, and therefore we are quite constrained in the kinds of improvements we actually can make. The boundaries also create distances between different types of sciences, the social sciences versus biological sciences. It can create tensions within sciences. I mentioned the kinds of boundaries we have, say, in sociology, where we might have some sociologists thinking medical sociologists really is not within the realm of sociology. And it can create tensions between researchers and communities. And I just want to mention a couple of quick things about what we might be looking to remove some of these, not remove the boundaries, but create more blurring between boundaries. That is to create some incentives to blur them. I think NIH in recent years has created some RFAs that look at trying to establish these kinds of community academic kinds of partnerships. Also to create the mechanisms by which we do that. Bell Laboratories had some wonderful ways of creating spaces in which communities and scientists could interact. And I think those might be kind of one mechanism. They were called collaboratories, where people could come together in protective spaces to discuss new ideas without the notion that we had to protect our own boundaries. And then to establish the kinds of environments that seek to blur these kinds of boundaries. The conferences like this are outstanding examples, but I think we can also think of other mechanisms, such as having more intensive kind of discussion groups among scientists, where we're less focused on presenting our research, but more in terms of trying to understand what each other is doing, and then to think about what the application are for our different kinds of disciplines. I just want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. One, that if when we look at the boundaries and the kind of distinctions between science, policy, and practice, this is what our logo is for this conference. And I think in 10 years, if we can begin to look at these kinds of issues in a much more integrated way, where the boundaries are less defined and there is more overlap between the three legs here. I just want to leave you with two quotes. This comes from Christopher Edley, who was the law school dean at Berkeley. Study of race is not rocket science. It's harder than rocket science. Race demands an intellectual investment equal to the task. It also demands relentlessness in research and teaching that will overwhelm the human tendency to let our differences trigger the worst in our natures. And finally, science by itself is a hollow vessel, and social justice without evidence remains only a vision. Thank you very much.
I would like to thank all the speakers and this session. Don't leave, because this session is continuing on.
Right?
Oh. You can get lunch.
Okay, I'd like to thank the panel. It was a very interesting and so Representative Congressman Cummings is on his way. What I'd like to ask for you to do is to go outside and get your lunch, but to please bring it back in. So come back as quickly as you can. He's rushing here from a meeting, and if you would just get your lunch and come back as quickly as possible, you can eat in here and we'll be able to keep moving. Thank you.